Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Skalk Bazedenhout is a South African comedian, actor, and performer. It was obvious to Skalk's parents that he would study drama, and to help numb the pain, they sent him away to study at the University of Cape Town. While studying in Cape Town, Skalk quickly grew dissatisfied with watching Suits on repeat in his single bed. His drama degree was still 4 years away, but he needed a creative outlet now, so he started doing stand-up comedy in April 2011. On stage, Skalk is fun and energetic and appeals to all. His performance highlights include headliner at comedy venues all around South Africa and the world, performed at comedy festivals worldwide, various corporate and charity events, successful runs of international one-man shows in the UK, Dubai, Australia, Netherlands, and more. Only Jokes Allowed on Netflix. Trevor Noah's opening act at various times since 2015. Recorded his own Comedy Central special in June of 2015. Is a nominee and winner of the Savannah Newcomer Award at the Comic Choice Awards in 2013. Nominee of Breakthrough Act at the Comic Choice Awards in 2014. Nominee and winner of the Intermediate Award at the Comics Choice Awards in 2015. Canna Award for Best Up-and-Coming Artist in 2015. Nominee of 2016 Fleur de Cap for Most Promising Student. Nominee of Comic of the Year at the Comics Choice Awards in 2023. His one-man shows include Second Language, Skalky, Keeping Up, Skalk Bazedenhout Levendig, Snoersin, and many more. His film and television appearances include playing the role of Danny in Hotel on CakeNet from 2017 to 2022, the leading role in Kennedy in 2018, support role in New Material in 2021, host of Op My Aish in 2022, and many more. Up next on Celeb Savant, discussing his journey in the entertainment and comedic world and his latest lead role in the romantic comedy in the Showmax original film, Soos Pineapple or Pizza, is Skalk Bazedenhout.
Where do we find you in the world and how are you doing?
How's it, man? I'm in my house in Belito at the moment. I very, very rarely get to be here. Because I'm always like traveling abroad or in South Africa. So nice to be home. Behind my camera that you can't see right now, my two dogs going absolutely insane. They are a handful, but it's nice to see them.
For the listener who thinks that this life is so glamorous, which it is to a certain degree, but it is tiring living out of a suitcase, correct?
Yeah, dude. I mean, I would say it's glamorous when you get to Trevor Noah, Beyonce level.
Yeah.
Sure, of course. Like, because then you are only flying business class and private. I mean, if you look at Taylor Swift, yeah, she's only staying in the ultra executive suites of the best hotels. So yes, that is glamorous. But I mean, on the level that me and most of the people in the industry operate, look, don't get me wrong. Like, we're not, you know, I'm not staying like in motels with the cockroaches. But you know, I'm like, I'm flying economy. I always find it so funny on international flights. I like, because like, you know, you like walk through business to get to your CP in economy. And then like when people recognize me who are in business, they're always like, oh, why aren't you in business? Because they can't fathom if you are in a movie, you are like rich and famous. And I'm like, guys, you are comparing it to Hollywood, which is not the same. Like, I promise you, the movie stars in South Africa, we are not flying business. We are very much economy passengers. So yeah, like in that regard, it's not glamorous at all. I mean, it's a lot of just waiting. You like wait for your Uber, then you like wait in the Uber to get to the airport, then you get to the airport, then you wait to check in your bag, then you wait at the security, then you, and yeah, once again, like all the things that make you not wait, you need the big bucks. But like, look, I would say I'm like middle tier. Like I'm fly economy, but I've got lounge access, you know, like I'm in the lounge.
Yes. Okay, Skulk, so now let's rewind. To very beginning, at what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you think, cool, you want to be in this comedic space in front of the camera and making people laugh, entertaining them? And how did that journey progress?
I'd say probably 8. It's a safe, yeah. Where also, like when you're young, like you don't really know, you know, like people. Even still, like when they're 5, they like want to be a policeman or whatever. And then in South Africa, you realize later, like, oh my word, I can't believe I wanted to be a South African policeman when I was 5. Imagine. especially when I love Jim Carrey, all the Ace Ventura movies. And like, yeah, that's what I wanted to do, you know, like make people laugh in movies and stuff. Stand-up, I discovered much, much later in life, only as a student. Of course, in high school, I knew what stand-up comedy was, but like I just watched very little of it because for Afrikaans kids, there wasn't like really, we weren't really exposed to. Also, like, you know, every generation and every culture has those DVDs that does the rounds,
yeah,
when they are like in high school. And For me and my peers, I would say, like, the DVDs they were doing the rounds were like Casper de Vries DVDs, which was way more like, it wasn't just straight stand-up. He was doing, like, songs and cabaret, and it was, like, more of, like, a show. It wasn't just stand-up. And yeah, because I can't sing or don't have, like, musical ability, I was kind of like, yeah, oh, I don't know about that. Even though I like, I absolutely like idolized him. So yeah, my focus was more always, I would say, like comedic acting, and then like through pursuing that kind of stand up came into my life. So yeah, now I've got best of both worlds, you know, like I do mostly stand up now, like that's definitely what fills my calendar. But like every year I try and make space for like at least one big acting project a year.
When you realized that the comedic or stage comedy did not have to include the cabaret, the dance, and the singing, was that a surprise? And then did you take naturally to it, or was it a long time for you to feel comfortable on the stage?
I always felt comfortable on a stage. I wasn't surprised that it didn't have to include singing and stuff, because like I knew Trevor Noah and I like you'd seen clips, you know.
Yeah.
But once again, I just like, it's clips that you see in very low quality on someone's cell phone, on someone's like BlackBerry at school. It's hardly anything. So yeah, I started it more as a hobby because I didn't get into the degree I wanted to get in first, which is a theater and performance acting degree at UCT. So I had this random, very general BA year, like random subjects just to fill my, you know, roster. Yeah. Stuff that I was not really interested in. It was just to, yeah. So I had this random first year where I was doing like English, which I later replaced with Afrikaans because I was like, why am I doing English? it's not like school going now, I have to do English.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if I don't have to do English, I'd rather do Afrikaans. Film and media studies, which also was more like the behind the scenes of film and media, which I'm not interested in. I think sociology was a subject which I cannot for the life of me tell you what was happening there. And then what it was even about, that really don't remember. And then drama. Drama was the only thing I was interested in. So I had to choose 3 other things that... Yeah. And then I started stand up because I was good at like finishing my projects as soon as I got them. So I really spent a lot of time watching Suits, to be honest, in my room in Res. And then I got the opportunity to do stand up, and I was like, yo, why not? Jeez, I'm sitting in the room half the time. I'm not like adding anything to my. And then, yeah, I started stand up. And to be honest, at first, I thought this is cool, this is interesting, and nice, like a thing to do when I'm an actor and maybe like I don't have a role and nice thing to do on the side. But then the more I was doing it, the more I realized I think I'm more of a comedian who can act as opposed to an actor who can do stand up. I think with a lot of like real comedians, though, I don't think anyone who's like super talented in stand-up comedy will do like one stand-up gig a year. It's mostly, I mean, I think the rare exception, someone like Eddie Murphy, like he did those two specials back in the day. He's obviously a talented comedian, but for some reason he's like, I'm never going to like beat this special again or these specials, and I'm quitting forever and I'm being an actor. But like most actors, like Chris Rock, Louis C.K., Bill Burr. Like, I mean, Bill Burr is now doing a proper play on Broadway. He's doing Glengarry Glen Ross. So, I mean, you need to be able to really act to do that. But I think all of them, they're like 90% of the time they're doing stand-up, and then here and there they do an acting project just because, yeah, I think most comedians can act, and most comedians like really love acting, yeah.
So obviously being a comedian, you have to be able to read the room, read the energy of the people and feel the interactions and the responses. So is that something that come naturally to you from the beginning, or have you built that up over time?
I think I built that up all the time. You know, like I was quite nervous when I did stand up the first few times because it's daunting, especially in South Africa, which is very multicultural.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm a white Afrikaans South African. Now you get up in a room where, like, let's say in Bromfontein, where people are your age, but no one is firstly white, never mind Afrikaans. And you're there, like, just complete fish out of water. It's very intimidating. A lot of audiences have that kind of, if you are not the same as them race-wise, culturally, they have this kind of attitude of like, okay, like, let's see what you can do, bro. Like, make us laugh. So, you know, and then I would just like do my set. But also, like, you don't really have a choice because you only have that set at that time. Like, at the beginning, you only have those 5 minutes and that's your repertoire. Obviously, the more material you start writing and the more stage time you get, the more you can be like, oh, okay, maybe this joke won't work. Let me try this one. Blah, blah, blah. But that only comes with experience. And I always like get people who message me, hey, I want to do stand up. Can you help me? Can you mentor me? And I'm like, no one can mentor you. Like you are your own mentor. The audience kind of coach you in a way because they teach you to be a better comedian normally from not laughing, unfortunately. Like I remember like when I started out, there was this one comedian who always would say, if you had like a really good gig and you come off stage and you're like a young comedian, you're like on top of the world and you're like, yes, you're like, I'm the shit. And then he would always go like, yeah, I mean, cool, you had fun, but you didn't learn anything. His opinion was that a good gig, you don't learn anything. It's just fun. And then if he had like a really tough one, like that almost would excite him. And you're like, and then he's like, that was, you know, then he'd come up to you and then you're like, no, I don't, that was a shit gig. And he's like, yeah, but you learned from that. And you walked off stage a better comedian. I promise you that.
That's interesting.
And up to an extent, he's right. You know, like obviously the goal is always to have more good gigs than bad gigs, but seeing the bad gigs as learning, and that's where you like really, and you know, on podcasts and stuff, you often listen to comedians and they're like, dude, I ate shit for the first few years of my career. Like, just like no one's laughing and just dying on my ass. Yeah, none of the excellent comedians because of that, I guess.
For you, the difference of being part of a repertoire of comedians doing sets after each other compared to doing your own show, a preference for either? You enjoy both? And how do you attack or approach each of those different scenarios?
I would say, I guess my own show is nicer or better because the audience can fool you. So as soon as you walk on stage, they're already, look, you can't serve them up cock. Like, it still needs to be funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, my audience, they hold me to the quality, I must say. And I think I'd like to think that my shows are normally of quite like a high standard. So I always have to at least match the show before. Yeah, people aren't shy to be like, I'm dreading last show, the last show more. But I mean, at the end of the day, still, they're on your side. You walk on, they're really like, we are here for you. You don't have to convince us that you're funny. We know you're funny. We just came to laugh. Where lineup, often, not everyone on the lineup is, I mean, in the audience is there for you. They maybe came to watch someone else on the lineup or just because they saw advertised comedy show, especially when I perform overseas. Look, I like the challenge, but then you first have to win them over before you can start having fun. So there, if you have a 10-minute set, you know, the first 5 minutes is just like being like, hey, guys, this is me. Please like me, basically. And then once you've got them on your side, then you can start having fun. Obviously, after a one-man show, if everyone's like, we loved it, yeah, it's lekker, but you're like, yeah, but you already walked in here being a fan of mine. So I didn't do that much. I just, you know, gave you some new jokes. But it's very fulfilling if you, like, especially when I perform in Australia and you, you know, like walk on stage and do my 10 minutes and then people afterwards say like, oh, you know, loved it, or I love you, or you're my favorite on the lineup, because then it's like, wow, I really like won this person. I took them from not knowing me at all. And in 10 minutes, I took them from not only knowing me, but like converting them to a fan. And yep. Now, if I come back and do a one-man show, they probably will come watch.
For your shows, what motivates your routine? How long do you prep to create that routine? Let's dive into the behind the scenes of before you're getting onto that stage.
Yeah, man. So I don't sit, and I think very few comedians do, but you never really sit and write. You know, you don't go, okay, today I'm going to write an hour. It's often, just as you move through life, you are constantly making notes and creating and often also you leave it to lastminute.com and you're like, I've done this before where I'm driving to Cape Town for the show, like with my dogs in the car, and I'm like, the show's in 2 days, and I've got like loose structure and loose bits, but like I don't have a show really. And then you like just, yeah, you're just like driving radio off, just thinking of jokes. But yeah, so a lot of my jokes are with life things. So if a lot is happening in my life, then generally you will write a lot of material. If it's like not that busy, then you'll probably write less. Last year, end of last year, I got divorced. So in like a short amount of time, it was like a lot of material, because every day it's like, now this is happening between me and my first wife. And then it's like, and now my friends are saying this. So there's like a lot going on, and just all of it had the potential to be material. So then, yeah, for example, like I think I managed to come up with a lot of content, and a lot of it is still in the form of notes on my phone. It's not necessarily full jokes. But yeah, I would say then in like the space of a month and a half, I did write a lot. Even though I wasn't in a funny mind space, it's just like, that's what you learn as a comedian, the skill to be able to go, let me just write this down. Later, when I'm in a better mind space, I can come back to this and make it funny and turn it into a joke. This is just a note to remember what happened. Okay. So, like, for example, like, I was crying in the woolies. And you're like, in that moment, you're like, I don't know how I can turn this into a joke yet, but you can recognize, geez, even though I'm devastated right now and in a very sad place, there is something funny about crying in a Woolworths. So let me just write down, you know, crying in the woolies next to the yogurt. And then like later you come back to it and then you can find the joke, you know what I mean? So, so then you create like a lot in a short space of time, and then later it's like a bit of a dead quiet place again. But I'd say a lot of comedians are churning out like an hour a year. Yeah. So it's kind of like that. And if you divide, let me see, I've got my calculator here in front of me. If you divide 60 minutes divided by 365 days in a year, so it's like 15% of a minute, 60 times 16%. So it's like 10 seconds a day if you work it out. Like you're just writing 10 seconds of funniness a day. But obviously you're not writing 10 seconds. On one day you'll be like, I've got a brilliant joke, and you'll write 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then nothing for 4 months maybe.
Do you enjoy doing audience work?
A little bit. I like including them a little bit, but for me, I'm very much like the audience must shush and like, let me do my thing. And, because once the audience get too like, oh yeah, this is also our show.
Yeah.
And then things just start getting out of hand. And then you start getting people who like, oh, I'm going to show everyone how funny I am.
Oh yeah.
And start shouting their own cuck. And, and then eventually you just become like a school teacher, because if you can't control the room, you basically eventually just being like, you know, in the middle of a joke, you're like, hey, can you, shush? And then like this person, they're like, hey, shut up. So yeah, I'm normally quite strict, and because I'm also like, I'm undiagnosed, but I'm pretty convinced I've got some form of ADD. So if I'm on stage and performing and someone is like chatting to their friend next to them, I can hear those whispers. I can see. It's distracting for me. It's also like, it's annoying for the people around them. So you're like, because like when you watch a show and people are talking behind you, it's super annoying. So then I'm also like aware of that element, that like the people around them are not having such a lacquer show because those two people are talking. So yeah, I often address those things in my show. And I know, of course, someone like Nathaniel, he's very strict with that. If you take out your cell phone, he cucks you out. If you talk, he cucks you out. Yeah. And then people always, and then often you'll hear people go, yeah, Nathaniel, like I went to go watch his show and he's so strict. And like, yeah, he's somewhere like cucked out a woman for using her phone or like for speaking. And I'm like, he's not being strict. He's
exactly.
He's just enforcing what should be the norm.
Etiquette, exactly.
Yeah, it's theater etiquette. And I didn't even experienced that, but he comes from a generation where like he started performing without cell phones.
Yes.
Imagine like you are a performer and you used to like having everyone's undivided attention. There's nothing that people have on their person. I mean like in the 80s or 90s, if you've got a babysitter at home, she's only reaching you when you get back home.
Exactly.
Like then you know if everything's fine. And then this like device comes along that just like people get addicted to, and you go from like having everyone's undivided attention just by from that to like people just, you see these little lights pop up, you know? And I think people don't realize how not anonymous they are in the crowd. Like
yes.
you quickly check a message on your phone, but from the stage, from our perspective, your whole face lights up. Like it's this little like blue face then suddenly in the audience.
Whenever I'm in theater and if anyone near me is with a phone on, I say, put the phone down. Yesterday, in fact, I went to go see Alan Pamitti's show, and these people like talking intermittently during the show. And eventually I turned around and said, can you please keep quiet? I was like, we're in a show. Can you shush?
There is this perception that like, if it's a play, you know, if it's a drama, it's Sandra Prinsloo, then there's this perception that like, now we behave ourselves because it's theater. And then with comedy, the perception is that like, oh, well, it's comedy, man. It's Musnow. It's fun. It's chilled. It's more relaxed. And I'm of the opinion that there's no difference. Etiquette, there should be no difference etiquette wise between my show or Alan Committee's show and a show with Sir Ian McKellen. Both are equally, like, both are theater. The difference is just in my show, you will be laughing more. But, like, it doesn't mean that because I'm a stand up and I'm not playing a character and I'm telling real stories from my life that you should now be like, fucking pissed and
yes,
like drank too much before and like talking to your friends and like tapping them on the shoulder and going, hey man, you do that. You always do that, man. I make it sound like it's a big problem in my life. Like my audiences are generally like very, very nice, very accommodating. But you know, alcohol is an ugly thing. And don't get me wrong. I love my red wine. I love alcohol. But normally if someone is misbehaving in a show, alcohol is always, always, always the common denominator. Yes. It's always that the person has had too much to drink. Like, I almost want to say 100% of the time.
Absolutely. Now let's take a focus. What do you enjoy about acting and being behind the camera? Sorry, in front of the camera, not behind. Being in front of the camera, what do you enjoy about that?
Yeah, I think it's just the difference in, it's a different art form, you know? Like I, very early on as a student, separated comedy and acting completely because it's two different things. And kind of my lecturers almost in a way forced me to, because often they would say like, Skulk, you know, like we're trying to mark you on your acting, but you're being Skulk the comedian. So you're playing for the laughs and this is like Shakespeare, it's you shouldn't be playing for the laughs.
Yeah.
And that's just because like, yeah, it's so easy to get into that like comedic flow. And I had to learn to be like, when I'm on stage and I'm acting, I'm not Skulk the comedian. I'm whoever I'm playing. Cause it's so easy to go into my normal like mannerisms. So yeah, I always completely separate the two. They're completely different things to me, completely different art forms. But at the same time, they're in the same family. So I see it almost like as like a, if you're an athlete and there's a huge difference between the 100 meters and the 400 meters. You know, like if you tell Usain Bolt to suddenly run 400 meters, he's going to, it's a different ball game.
Yeah.
But they're in the same family. So, something like that. So, I love acting, man. Like it was my first love. It was my first love before I even knew, like I said, what stand-up even was. The sad thing in South Africa is just like in front of the camera, you know, like those bloopers that you see always at the end of the movie, like the, especially the Jackie Chan movies, they love a blooper. Eh? Like it's always like Jackie Chan movies, always like the bloopers at the end is as long as the movie. We don't have like that many takes and stuff in South Africa. It's just like our budgets are obviously just you don't have the luxury to do a scene 50 times, you know. So often, if once you've nailed it, even if it's not your best take, if it's just a take that's usable, and you're already like in trouble for the day time wise. You know, the director will be like, cool, I'm happy, let's move on. Because that's also a skill you have to learn as a South African director, is that to be able to like, I've got what I need, let me move on. Because it's either I do 20 takes of this one scene or I don't finish the day and I have to sacrifice. And because of the budgets also, you know, like that story of The Revenant where they're like, you know, they came back day after day to do this scene because the director was like, you can only shoot for this time of the day because yeah, the light's just like perfect, and you know there was the budget was just like we'll come back until it's done, whether it's a week or a month or whatever. And I just laughed so much when I heard that because I was like, imagine that's a director to come direct something in South Africa with the South African budget. That the AD will tell him, Bruh, if you don't have this scene by five, that's what, then you don't have it.
Yeah.
There's no coming back tomorrow. There's no money. So yeah. And I'm not saying it for us, you know. If anything, that's why South African crew are so good, you know, because we can work under pressure, because it's like, okay, guys, we've got a turnaround here of 30 minutes to light the scene. And the crew, like the hustle, that's why they shoot so many international ads here, because the crew work so well, they work so hard, they work so efficient, they work so fast, because that's just our normal speed. You know, in France, like, you're allowed to, as a crew member on a shoot, whether it be a movie or an ad, you're allowed to have a glass of wine
yes,
at lunch. Yeah. So that just gives you an idea of, like, the tone. And then also, like, as an actor, you learn to, like, from the first take to be able to nail it, because sometimes you only will get one take before, like, we have to move along.
Okay, so now tell us the latest movie on Showmax, the name of it, who you portray, and a little bit of an overview of what it's about.
Yeah, so it's called Pineapple Pizza. It's about this guy, Baldu, who's a chef, and his girlfriend left him, his fiance, and he's completely heartbroken. He's back with living with his parents, and they've kind of forced him to go on this singles retreat. And he does it to get them off his back, and they feel he'll go find true love again. And he does. He doesn't think he will, because he's still hung up about the previous girl. But he does believe in true love. And then there's another girl, Becca, who basically goes on a dare. Like, she does not believe in true love at all. She thinks it's all just love is basically just chemicals in your brain. It's as easy as that. And her brother and her brother's boyfriend say, okay, go do this thing, and they make a little bet. If you do find true love, you have to do this and that. So immediately, like with most rom-coms, obviously they hate each other at first, because they've got such varying degrees, varying ideas of love. And then, yeah, it develops from there. But it was really nice, also really nice to shoot in an ensemble. We were like a big ensemble, you know, because it's the retreat with a lot of people. And often, like, once again, with South African budgets and stuff, the writers tend to not write ensemble scenes, because it's more actors that you have to get, it's bigger scenes and stuff. But if you're clever about how you shoot and how you direct and stuff, it can work. So, you know, for that reason, a lot of South African movies will just be the two main characters that you see all the time, which can also get a bit boring, because it's like other characters color in the world
exactly
of in which the story takes place. And so it was nice to be in an ensemble cast as well, and just open up the world a little bit, because we had we mostly in one location all the time. So that makes it easier. But yeah, I only watched it also for the first time on Valentine's Day when it came out. I sat here on my couch with a glass of wine and, like, opened my laptop and watched it. And it's very easy watching. It's just like a movie that you watch on the couch, you know, with a glass of wine.
Yep.
It's a little bit on the raunchy side. I would have actually liked to, if we could, push the raunchiness even more. But I think for an Afrikaans rom-com, it's definitely more on the raunchy side.
Okay.
And yeah, it's very cute. You know, even I at the end, I was like, oh, that's
okay.
Cute.
Okay.
Even though I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. So, Skalk, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Well, I do travel all over the world with my comedy. So, please follow me on social media. Just keep an eye. I might be performing. And, you know, it's so hard with social media, because, like, the algorithm puts everything down. So especially if you're not paying.
Yes.
You're not paying to say, watch me in Adelaide.
Yeah.
And now if you post, watch me in Adelaide, the algorithm is just going to push that down. So often, you know, I will do a show where I'm like, I'm coming to Adelaide, I'm coming to Adelaide, I'm coming to Adelaide, like every day, like please, Adelaide, how's it? I'm coming. And then a week later, I'll always get a message being like, when are you coming to Adelaide? Like a week after the show. And I was like, I was literally just there with a bunch of empty seats. Like I could have needed, I really could have needed you at the show. And then they're like, oh, I just didn't know. I just didn't see the posts. So just keep an eye on my website, on our social media. I'm always posting where in the world I am. I'm going to be doing a big world tour again next year. So this year I'm going to do Australia again, but I'm not doing Europe and the UK. Next year I'm doing a new show in Europe, UK, Australia, UAE, South Africa. I'm not doing a big South African tour this year. Next year I'll be doing big South African tour again. So yeah, super excited for all of that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.